This is Chatter on Books. Use only as directed. I'm Jamie McIntyre. Here's Tori Clark.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Chatter on Books. It is great to see the people I get to see. Hope everybody's doing well and staying safe. And just a little bit, we'll be talking to one of Chatter on Books' favorite alums, Admiral James Tavridis, best-selling author who has written several bestsellers in the nonfiction space. And he's coming back to us with fiction, a really terrifying novel called 2034, a novel of the next world war. And the word plausible keeps coming up, which you'll find out why this is terrifying, but it's all too real. Tonight, we have Claude Jennings doing all the important work, David Aldridge, Mark Stern, and Jamie McIntyre. It's reunion night. Hi, guys.
Hey.
Hi, everybody.
Good to be here.
Good to have you. Okay, Mark Stern, you have a new podcast we want to hear about.
Oh, yes. I'm launching in a couple of weeks from now a podcast that is being put on by the United States Tennis Association. And hold on, I got to get the – we had like a group session for what the name of the show should be. We came up with Courtside, the U.S. Open podcast.
Nice.
And it's very exciting. It's going to be a year-round podcast twice a month. And then when I'll be broadcasting again from the U.S. Open this year. And when we're up there for – I think it's like 17 days – there'll be a new podcast every night while we're up there with
new
material.
Nice.
So yeah, very excited. And I can say, because I did the interview earlier today, the absolute first guest on the show will be Michael Chang. And for those who aren't huge tennis fans, Michael Chang was the youngest man to ever win a Grand Slam. He won the French Open at the age of 17, already making me feel like a failure at the age of 19. And just a terrific guy, and a really, really interesting conversation we had about a bunch of things. But I can't wait for folks to
awesome. To see it. Mark, I've known you for a long time, and you and I have seen each other in a lot of situations, including bars, live nativity scenes. I've never seen you with a tennis racket in your hands.
I love tennis.
I know you love tennis, but did you ever play tennis?
Yes, I played for a long time. And up until a couple of years ago, I was still playing. But then I really sort of ran out of a court to play with or people to play against. So I haven't
played. Because you were so good.
You get graded after. Like, I don't want to lose this turn again. No, I was not very good. I was slow, but I also had like no power on any of my shots. So it's a really great combination. The thing I do the best is I watch so much John McEnroe that when I serve, you're like, wow, that looks like John McEnroe, until I actually hit the ball and you're like, oh, that's not John.
From
that's
your description, I was thinking more like Bobby Riggs.
Yeah.
Kind of wily, but maybe not too fast.
Right. Okay, Jamie McIntyre, looking across the top here. David's got a podcast, or two or three. Mark's got a podcast. I have a podcast. You need a podcast.
You mean there are plenty of podcasts out there? I don't know how you compete.
No, it's like women in purses. Everybody needs to have one, and you can never have too many. Come on.
All right, I'll work something up.
I think you could do knowing
problem solved.
Knowing your background and knowing what you know and how good you are in national security, I think you could do a really smart, interesting, entertaining podcast. I think you should.
All right, I'll write it on my to-do list.
It's on your bucket list.
Right after
Mark
taking
podcast.
The azalea bush out that's dead. I got to do that.
Okay, I have to do a little. We're going to stick with Jamie. So, Jamie, a month or so ago, maybe 2 months ago, somebody from the Gaithersburg Book Festival emailed me and said, Roberta, as in Roberta McIntyre, says, we need to have you host one of the virtual panels for the Gaithersburg Book Festival, which is virtual again. We had Judd Ashman on for a couple weeks ago. What is Roberta's connection with the Gaithersburg Book Festival?
Well, she got roped into being on, you know, the board or whatever. But Roberta, my wife Roberta, is one of these people who the entire time my kids were growing up and she was staying home taking care of them. She was one of these people that made like everything else in the world work while you people were out at jobs like me. I was out of a job. So she organized like group piano lessons for the school and the after prom party. And she was always volunteering with something. She now works full time. But she still volunteers, and that's one of the things she volunteered at. And, you know, the Gaithersburg Book Festival, which is really a fabulous event, really got hit hard by the pandemic and not being able to do things in person. They worked really hard on coming up with a virtual format that people would be interested in. And of course, so naturally you came to mind. because, you know,
we
ratings.
She'll do anything.
And so how did it go, by the way?
Thank you very much for asking. It went great. And if people need something to do tomorrow, they put all of it on YouTube. We pre-record the panels and the sessions, and then they're running them, I think, almost every single day. If you go to GaithersburgBookFestival.org, you can see all the authors, the schedule, and the downside, to your point, was they didn't have it in person. But the upside, and Judd Ashman talked about this with us a couple weeks ago, is they've been able to reach so many different authors they might not have otherwise gotten. And so I got to do a session with P. Jelly Clark, who has a wonderful book called A Master of Gin, and Maroa Yejide, who is actually a DMV native, who has this fabulous book called Creatures of Passage. And the two of them together, they didn't really know one another, but their books are a little similar in that it's magical. You have 1912 Cairo, you have modern day Anacostia, you have a magical taxi that takes people through these strange worlds, but two really fabulous young authors that I think you're going to be hearing a lot from. So if you go to GaithersburgBookFestival.org and look up the schedule, then you can see where you can click onto YouTube and watch this. And there's tomorrow night, I believe, yeah, tomorrow night at 7 p.m.
I just remember that Roberta said to me, you know, like, who do we know who knows anything about books? And I said, you know, nobody comes to mind, but maybe Tori would do it anyway.
Exactly. I'm happy to. Okay, so we did that. Now we're going to do what I'm calling love it or hate it. Mm-hmm. Does anybody in this show, have you ever heard of, have you ever experienced Blinkist?
I read about it.
Not until you brought it to my attention today.
Exactly.
Yes, yeah, I had not heard of it. And now that I have, I hate it.
Yeah.
Okay, explain what it is, Mark. Now, if you guys, you clearly don't listen to WTOP, because I do. And I constantly heard this ad, but I never paid any attention to it. Mark?
I don't pay attention to ads.
From what I could gather, it's basically a summation of any book in like 15 minutes.
Yeah.
And so sort of, I guess it's an audio version of it. So it's sort of like an audio version of what we had is when I was a kid, Cliff Notes.
Yeah.
I think there's something else, Spark Notes now or something like that. But I just, and I think the I don't want to say the propaganda because that's not the right word, but the spiel I saw with it was like, yeah, everybody says they want to read a book, but nobody ever has time. So now you can get past that with Blinkist. And yeah, and you don't have to waste all that time reading the book. And I was like, yeah, sure. Like, what's War and Peace going to be the summation for? Well, there was war and there was peace. You miss all the elegance, you know. And I was looking up passages that you would completely miss of these brilliant writers if you just get the summation. Like, the whole point of reading the book is the journey of it. Am I right, or am I way off base here?
I had two thoughts about this. One was, like you said, this concept has been around for a long time, right?
Cliff Notes.
We all had Cliff Notes in school. I remember we used to have a book in our, literally in our bathroom, called The Great American Bathroom Book, which was a giant volume of all the classics and everything reduced to a single page for each one. And, you know, there's been, you know, theater companies do 1-minute versions of Shakespeare's play. I mean, this concept has been around for a long time. But to me, it's kind of like, you know, if I didn't have time to read, I didn't want to read the book, it's like, well, you know, would I hire someone to go have dinner at a great restaurant and just like write me a 10-second, you know, report on how it was so I could enjoy it vicariously?
Yeah. Yeah.
Or to take it to an extreme of would I hire someone to have sex with my wife and then just give me a report later on how it all turned out? I mean, you know, it's the experience. It's not hearing about the synopsis later.
I agree completely. And I wondered, and I looked, I could not find out. They summarize these books, and it's audio and written, but never will take you more than 15 minutes. Here are some of the titles: The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, God Help Us, Getting Things Done. It's a lot of self-help stuff. Drive by Daniel Pink. We've had Dan Pink on the show. But I wonder, do the authors get anything? Is somebody,
I don't think so.
Jump in. Terrible.
Can I come in?
Yeah.
Oh, Admiral, of course.
So I'm an author who is on Blinkist, and no, you do not get anything, but I'll give you one positive thought about it, taking into account all the negatives here, is that it gives you a way to look at 50 books and to think about, which one of these would I like to read? And I think that's a positive attribute.
Okay. Yeah.
But also, you know, book reviews pretty much serve the same purpose. I'm sure many of you have had the experience that I've had where I've read a really good review of a book, and after I read it, It was so detailed and so covered so many points. I felt like, okay, I got it. I don't need to read that book.
Right.
Because the book review was so thorough. And in some ways, it sort of feels, it's kind of like a mini book review. I have to say, though.
It is. I'll tell you what it is. It is a tweet of a book review.
I was thinking about this because one of the books that's in the Great American Bathroom book is Tale of Two Cities. And I actually thought, well, you know, Dickens actually summed the whole book up right in the first sentence, right? It's the best of times, it's the worst of times. You got it.
Done.
Wasn't Dickens's deal that he was writing, it was like a weekly serial or something like that? So his whole objective was to make it as long as possible to string out that paycheck. So, of course, he was like, hey, let's make this thing really long. And now Blinkist wants to sum it up in no time at all. Now, I will say this, because I had this conversation with a friend of mine about Audible. Because I'm a big Audible person.
Yeah, me too.
And they said, well, isn't that kind of cheating? Because you're not reading the book. And Audible is you're actually hearing the actual text of all the books that you read, to my understanding. I don't think they abridge anything. And I said to my friend, look, to me, that's a great way where I can consume books while I'm doing other things. You guys know I go on all these great hikes, and I can't tell you the huge volumes of knowledge that I have consumed over the last year alone through Audible. So I am a big fan of Audible. I don't feel like that's cheating.
Because you're experiencing the whole thing.
Yeah.
From start to
Admiral, what is the blink? What is the Blinkist? What's the rundown on your book, 2034? What did they say about your?
No.
There was a war and somebody won.
No, my novel 2034 is not on there. It's my two previous books, Sea Power, A History and the History and Geopolitics of the World's Oceans, and Sailing True North, 10 Admirals and the Voyage of Character. End of plug. But
for Sailing True North, which was the 10 Admirals, what do they do? Two admirals? I'm going to go listen to that one.
I'm not even going to answer that.
It's like the old joke that if television news had been around to cover the Moses coming down the mountain with the Ten Commandments, he would say, I've just received the Ten Commandments. Here are the three most important.
All I can say is I hope I never again hear about the bathroom book.
Yeah, me.
The Great American Bathroom Book. I have it here somewhere. I can hold it up.
Don't bring it out. Okay, that's a good segue. I'm going to leave Channing Tatum and his children's book for another time, but I am going to return to it because I personally find it very icky that Channing Tatum, Magic Mike, has a children's book out. But we'll come back to it another time.
Icky.
Okay, now you're forcing me.
To write a book? Everybody writes kids' books.
Okay, Roger Ebert, the great Roger Ebert, when he reviewed Magic Mike, the movie in which Channing Tatum starred.
Yes.
Do you know what the headline was? Crotches for Rent, $2.
That sounds like the latest review.
Channing Tatum, I'm showing this so you guys can see it.
When there's Channing Light, you can see it now.
Channing Tatum, the one and only Sparkella.
Okay.
Now, Channing Tatum seems like a perfectly lovely guy.
You know, they're actors. They don't act, they're not actually the people that they play.
No, he was. I think he was a stripper.
Yeah. He was?
He was a stripper before he became an actor. Yeah. That was why the whole Magic Mike, that was stories of his time on the whatever they call it, the dance floor, I guess.
I can't get up the outrage, Tor.
Oh, God. No, and it's just this. Okay. You know what? Maybe my outrage really is about the book because
I don't know. The book's probably dreadful, but that's not.
Yeah. The one and only Sparkella is the story of an unconditional father-daughter team, characters that sweetly remind each other to be true to themselves and that it is okay to be different, even if that is difficult for those around them to initially accept and understand. While the book, it's just terrible. And the glitter poop.
Yeah, I think I'm going to go with the Great American Bathroom Book. Go ahead and bring that back.
Thank you, Admiral. I bet you could still get that book on eBay.
Oh, my God. Yeah, and what you could probably get that book in the little, do you guys have the little bookshelf libraries that show up in the parks and your corners and things like that?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I love those. Book.
I am positive it's in one of those.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Everybody
if it's not, it's going to be after this podcast because I'm going to offload mine.
Everybody wants me to write a children's book. So But I can't because it would suck, which is awful. So
trust me, as someone who's written a children's book, you could do better than I can. Trust me. Yeah. No, yeah. You're right. Every celebrity out there, right. You know, an athlete seems
Jamie
like they're writing
Lee
a
Curtis
kid's
write a children's book.
Yeah. Right? Everybody is. The only thing I will say in defense of Mr. Tatum is I wanted to write him off as like, oh, look at this pretty boy. Great. He's up there doing his thing. I completely discounted him. And then I see his movies and I'm like, you know what?
Yeah.
Guy's really good. He's really good. He makes me laugh. He's funny. Like inevitably, whatever he does, I enjoy. So I have not read Sparkella yet, but I imagine it might make me smile.
It's your birthday present.
And it was something he did, you know, his relationship with his daughter and
fine.
So I wish.
But then it's going to be an animated cartoon and that'll be a feature length movie. And then there's going to be a clothing line. I promise you.
Then they'll be giving out toys at McDonald's. And then,
exactly.
Then you're done.
And then it will not be on the Golden Globes.
Right. No, nothing will be. Right. Yes.
Okay. Should we talk about a fabulous book called 2034?
Yes.
Let's do that. Wait, before we get to it, I have to show you my high school tennis racket because we were talking about tennis and Michael Chang. Mm-hmm. And, I am that Michael Chang wannabe, 5'6" tall, trying to play tennis. It is a tough row to hoe.
Yes.
And I just want to say thanks, Mark, for mentioning short tennis players, because I am one of them.
Admiral, I'm 5'7" listed in the books, but I'm probably not quite that. So you and I playing a match would be terrific.
That's a deal. We'll do it.
Yes.
And that's an Arthur Ashe model. Right.
It is good for you for knowing that.
I've
played with that with great pride and for any number of reasons. Speaking of books, if you have not read Arthur Ashe's memoir written at the end of his life, Days of Grace.
Yes.
Oh, my God. In the letter at the end of it, addressed to his daughter, Camera, will break your heart. And it is a gorgeous book, and he was an extraordinary figure.
He was.
Yes, great guy.
I had to interview him once or twice. And
what was he like?
It was awful. Oh, God. Hi. He was wonderful. What do you, great. He was smart, and he was strong. And it was Michael Jordan, I don't care about Michael Jordan. I can interview Michael Jordan in my sleep. But Arthur Ashe, I was literally tongue-tied. I literally couldn't.
Wow.
Four sentences to ask him. I couldn't ask him questions. I couldn't. He was just Arthur Ashe.
I bet he was very kind.
So you meant you were awful, not he was awful.
Yeah.
So I'll tell you two things about Arthur Ashe, which you may or may not know. One is a quote. One is that he was a commissioned officer in the U.S. Army.
Did not know that. Wow.
Yep. Wow. And he and Stan Smith from that era. And then secondly, my favorite quote by Arthur Ashe is about tennis, but it's really about life. And it's that you are never playing your opponent. You are always playing yourself.
Yeah.
Boy, is that profound and true. And
it really is.
He had the gravitas to bring that line off, which nobody on this podcast has.
That's it.
That's that right.
Okay. Continuing chatter on Arthur Ashe, about 6 or 7 months ago, Brian and I, my husband and I, just needed to get away for a couple of days. So we went to Richmond, which is a lovely city.
Yes.
They were in the midst of dealing with Monument Avenue, which had all the humongous monuments to Robert E. Lee and you name it. Mm-hmm. And they were taking them all down. And there's a monument to Arthur Ashe. And one of the most wonderful things, we happened to be there on a beautiful weekend, great weather, just the never ending stream of people and families. And they were every size and shape and color and from lots of different places taking their pictures near the Arthur Ashe statue. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
It's really lovely.
That's lovely. You could write a book about what it took to get that statue put up. It was years.
Is that right?
Years of strife.
Hey, David, on the long list of books you could write, that could be a book you could write.
Could be. It could be. I would actually like to write a book like that. That would be
Should write a book about Arthur Ashe. About his impact on sport, his impact on American life, with what Tori just said. That's the coda to the book.
He was an amazing person.
No, I'm dead serious.
You should write it soon so the people who knew him and played against him and with him and the people in Richmond at the time are still alive.
This is a good point out of you.
It's on the
so Tori now has given you an assignment. She's given me an assignment.
That's right.
You know, you got some for the other people too.
You start podcast. Me write Ash book.
Yeah. The Admiral needs needs a podcast as well. Or Admiral, do you have one? Do you have a podcast?
No, blissfully. I think I'm pretty much the only adult male in the country without a podcast.
Yeah, it's very true. It's very true. Okay, let's talk about 2034, a novel of the next world war, which is great. So I've watched a lot of your interviews about this book, Admiral, and I've read a lot of them. And I'm just trying to think, okay, how can we possibly ask him something he hasn't been asked? But we have to ask, because we've had you on about The Leader's Bookshelf. We had you on about Sailing True North. Bestsellers, you have nailed the national security space in the last 5-10 years. What made you switch to fiction? And as part of that, tell us about your co-author, Elliot Ackerman.
I'll start with my co-author, which is just such a great story. He and I are fellow graduates of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. So I've known him about a decade. He is someone who graduated as 9/11 was happening, volunteered into the U.S. Marines, did 5 combat tours in Iraq and Afghanistan, becomes a CIA officer in Afghanistan, becomes then a White House fellow, and then decides to be a novelist in his early 30s, right? Writes 4 novels, the second of which is shortlisted for the National Book Award, Dark at the Crossing. And most annoyingly, he's like 6 feet tall and really good looking. So what I am doing, even getting to work with that guy, let alone know him, I have no idea. But let me tell you the story of why a novel and how Elliot and I got together. So I started writing this novel about the future, about 2034, by actually looking at the past and looking at the Cold War with the Soviet Union and thinking, okay, why did we never end up going to war with the Soviet Union? I think part of the reason were works of fiction, movies like Dr. Strangelove, The Bedford Incident, the novel, Tom Clancy's Red Storm Rising, The Third World War by Sir John Hackett, On the Beach by Neville Shute. You get the idea. So I went to my publisher and I said, I have this idea. I want to write a novel because then people can imagine the future, imagine how terrible it would be if we ended up in a war with China. And then we could kind of reverse engineer our way back to the present.
Right.
So my editor at Penguin Press heard one word, which was novel. Uh-huh. And he said, you know, Admiral, you're a great guy. You've written some very, very good books, but you're not a novelist. And I mean, I was like an 8-year-old kid. I mean, I...
Devastating? You know, was that just devastating to hear?
Hugely devastating. You know, and I believe every writer of nonfiction, you know, like Walter Isaacson, wakes up every morning, looks in the mirror and says, I could write a novel. I certainly have always said that. So I said to my editor, you know, I can too write a novel. I'll show you. And, you know, I wrote like a detailed outline and 2 sample chapters and brought it all back in a month later and gave it to him. And he called me up a month later and he said, Admiral, you're a great guy.
Oh,
you're a good writer, but you are not a novelist.
Ooh.
But we have a novelist in house, a guy named Elliot Ackerman. And so universes collide. I've known Elliot for a decade. He had been my writer in residence at the Fletcher School. There was a good investment, Dean Stavridis, when I was the dean at the Fletcher School. And so luckily for me, Elliot agreed to be my partner, and we ended up writing this novel together. So
place at the right time.
Oh, my God.
The right people.
And, you know, the other answer to the question, why a novel instead of yet another boring, dry policy book, you know, why we shouldn't go to war with China by Admiral Stavridis.
Right.
I just felt like bigger audience. Mm-hmm. You can get out of the straitjacket of nonfiction. You can splash some paint around the canvas. And above all, characters. You know, if you think about your favorite book, and maybe at the end of the show, we can go around and say, what's your favorite book? But it's really about who's your favorite character.
Yeah, right? Very much so. Very much so. Okay, I'm going to bring Jamie McIntyre in because Jamie always counsels me on the show that I have to actually ask the authors what it's about. But Jamie was telling us 2 months ago, he was the first one to read the book. I happen to have read it and listened to it. The narration is great, by the way, on the audio version. Jamie, give us the CNN headlines version of 2034.
So what really struck me about this book was the...
Can you do it in a cool Jamie McIntyre voice?
It's the only voice I have. I don't know. Ladies and gentlemen.
That's right. If you put your hand up.
From Admiral, yeah, I have to hold my hand. No. So what struck me about this was, I mean, in one word, in the Blinkist thing, it was the verisimilitude of how realistic this was. And, you know, I've been covering the Pentagon. I've never served in the military, but I've been covering the Pentagon for almost 20 years now. And so I've heard a lot and I've learned a lot. And I learned a lot in this book, especially I learned a lot of a slang that I didn't know. So a lot of Navy slang that I didn't wasn't aware of. But what really struck me about it was how true to life it was. I could just picture all of the things happening. And as the Admiral said, it's the characters that you learn the story through. And of course, the, you know, one of the things, a couple of years ago, I did a series of stories for the PBS NewsHour on, you know, our nuclear weapons policy and updating the nuclear triad.
Because people who watch PBS have a hard time sleeping, so and, they need it.
So, yeah. And one of the things we did, along with the producer who produces a series with me, Dan Segalen, over at PBS NewsHour, we went on like a speaking tour to talk to people about this big question was coming up. This is in like 2016, about, you know, how and when should we update all of our nuclear weapons? And one of the things that struck me was in the 60s, when we were debating a lot of the Cold War stuff, there were these great movies around that illustrated the conundrum of nuclear weapons, you know, Failsafe, where Henry Fonda is the president and he's got to make these terrible decisions because of nuclear weapons. And of course, my very favorite, Dr. Strangelove. And those kinds of fictional accounts really helped, I think, the American public sort of grasp what the basic arguments were about and how serious this was and how tenuous our existence could be if people made bad decisions. And but there's nothing like that about China, and that's where I thought this book really filled the void. It really helps you understand you know, how, you know, smart people with the best intentions who have no intention to go to war can stumble sleepwalk into war, and then how it could turn out. And I have to admit that at some point I flipped to the end of the book to see if we all died in the end.
No, it is not. Okay. It is not apocalyptic.
Okay, but Admiral, set the scene for us and explain to us why we care about China, the South China Sea, and how small things can lead to big things. So set the scene for us.
I will. We have a basket of disagreements with China, which unfortunately are quite profound, starting with, as you mentioned, Tori, the South China Sea, which is a vast body of water. It's half the size of the continental United States. It's international waters, high seas. Anyone can sail through it, except China claims it as territorial waters. It's a preposterous claim, but if we acquiesce to it, they will suddenly own this vast sea space full of oil, gas, fisheries. And by the way, 40% of the world's trade passes through it. Number two, cyber, ongoing offensive cyber operations. Number three, intellectual property theft. Number four, unfair trade and tariff practices. Number five, humanitarian human rights violations. 1 million Uyghurs in concentration camps. You get the idea. I could go on and on. So with this basket of disagreements, I'm very concerned over the next 10 to 15 years, China will decide that they have gained enough military capability to make a move against the United States in the South China Sea. And the book opens with three Navy destroyers clipping through the South China Sea on a Freedom of Navigation patrol. I've done those patrols as a commander, as a commodore in command of that flotilla, as a strike group commander overseeing it. And in this case, by the end of the day, the first 20 pages of the novel, all three of those ships are at the bottom of the South China Sea, and it kind of unspools from there. Yeah. So this is a very real scenario. And I'll conclude this by saying any number of my very senior military friends and people like Secretary Bob Gates and Secretary Jim Mattis, who both blurbed the book,
right,
said to me, "Hey, Jim, really good book, but you got one big thing wrong. The date. It's going to be a lot sooner. That's really not what you want to hear.
I'm going to stop taping for a minute so I can get another beer. But to Jamie's point about just so real, you know, I have an ounce of knowledge about this area, but this whole thing was so real. One of the things I loved how you described was China constantly moving the fence line.
Yeah.
And the last, you know, previous administration, 4 years of, you know, I don't want to offend anybody out there, but wackadoodle, right? And we were so consumed with lots of things going on right here in Washington, D.C., that we didn't pay much attention to what China has been doing. But for the last several years, right, Emerald, they just keep moving the fence line and moving the fence
line. And they don't only move the fence line. Inside the fence, they are building artificial islands all over the South China Sea. These are massive man-made structures with airstrips, radars, missiles, troops, tanks. It's really quite incredible. Yeah. They built nine of these. And in the Navy, we don't call them artificial islands. We call them unsinkable aircraft carriers because that's how China would use them in a combat scenario. So again, this is a long way of saying that we've got to figure out how to avoid this outcome. We got to bend that relationship with China without breaking it and ending up in a war.
Right.
So, Tori, can I just say, make one more observation, then I'll kind of shut up and let other people talk. But just a couple of things. One is, it shouldn't get lost in anybody that this is a terrific story.
Yes.
The story, you know, the characters following them, the dilemmas they have, it's kind of a cliche, but it is kind of a page turner. And the important thing about that to me is, you know, we're in this period right now where people are so flooded with information. They're so confused about so many things. Right now, where the government is trying to figure out how to convince people to take the to get the vaccine so we can get the herd immunity. And one of the things that they've discovered is that, you know, public service announcements don't really help. People don't trust politicians. They don't trust the media. But stories about things about COVID, that's a thing that seems to get through to people. And so what this book does in a way that's very entertaining is by telling you a story, as Admiral Stravita said, you can imagine this. It seems very real, and it really helps you understand it in a way that's not another, excuse me, dry policy book about why we couldn't get a war with China.
I agree completely. I'm going to ask Mark and David something. It humanizes it. I mean, we were laughing earlier, Admiral, about your globe there. Half the people in the country wouldn't recognize what that is, much less be able to find China. And it just seems so big and so far away. But there's not an aspect of our lives that isn't touched by China. Yeah. Mark, the entertainment world. You know, the movie industry.
Oh, yeah.
China has a huge influence over what movies get made, how they get made, right? Yeah. How they get distributed.
Sure.
Who's in them? David, sports. Mm-hmm. Any big professional league cares deeply about China, as we found out when, was it my future trophy husband, Steve Kerr? Who was it? Who said something?
Well, it was Daryl Morey, who was then the GM of Houston Rockets.
Yeah.
He essentially tweeted his support for the Hong Kong protesters and was just beaten figuratively about the head and shoulders by a whole mess of people. And, you know, to the point where there was serious contemplation in kind of the social media atmosphere about whether he should be fired.
Right.
You know? And I did a big story on it, it was a column really, but it was a reported column. And we are all hypocrites about China. Let's be honest about this. I got so many hate letters, tweets about me saying that. And I would always respond, how did you send this to me? Because if you send it on an iPhone, you're supporting China.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Right. So let's cop to it and acknowledge, as the Admiral says, that, you know, we've got to figure this thing out with them. You got to do it now before it's too late.
Yeah.
And can I just tell you an anecdote? So the book came out and I was called by the CEO of one of the largest studios in the country on a Friday, who said, I'm reading the book. I love it. The only question in my mind is whether we're going to do a movie or we're going to do a miniseries. Mm-hmm. Who's your agent? And I said, I don't have an agent. And I mean, I have a book agent, but my book agent would not be a Hollywood agent. So he said, get an agent, call me back on Monday, click. So we run around, we get an agent at UTA, a very good guy, give him the whole pitch. I call this CEO back on Monday and he says, bad news. I read to the end of the book and, you know, I just can't sell this in China. And if I do, none of my other pictures will get released.
Yeah,
this is a true story. This is a very real phenomenon and it's not right. China should not get a vote on whether or not we produce, particularly in my view, artistic content, let alone works of nonfiction, let alone drive our ships through the high seas in the South China Sea. We got to be careful we don't get canceled by China.
Right.
Yeah. Wow. Admiral, I mean, I think everybody knows this about what's going on in Hollywood, but yeah, I mean, there's script approval that has to be, because it's all about getting into that market. It's not making movies for the United States audience. It's about what can we sell over there. And to my knowledge, and I might be wrong in this, but I think I'm right. The only director who has said, no, there will be no changes. There will be no edits in my movie. And if you don't want to show it over there, I don't care. And that's Quentin Tarantino, because they wanted to edit out parts of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. I think maybe the Bruce Lee scenes. And he said, no, the movie's the movie. And if you don't want to show it there, I don't care. But most everybody else says they just see dollar signs. And I, you know, it's almost the Chinese have discovered our weakness is our greed. And it's the bottom line. And people just see dollar signs with that massive market. And it's Hollywood, it's sports, it's industry, it's everywhere. It's the cheap labor. And everyone sees, well, we can make so much money over there. Sure, we'll compromise our values a little bit here and there. And then you wind up not knowing where your values are because you're just, you know, and so it's very frustrating. I even a movie like the Midway that came out a couple of years ago, which was
great.
Yeah. But it was funded in part by China. And even though it's a true story of General Doolittle crash landing in China, and it's all part of that story, but they made it a larger part of that story to sort of, you know, throw some good light on the Chinese, even though, I mean, again, that's true, but it's like, it was almost like they insisted that that be in there for their market, you know?
Sure. So keeping this theme going, 2 or 3 months ago, I booked somebody for this show for June. Fabulous, fabulous person. Fascinating book. He's going to be great. And he and I have just a really interesting history. He emailed me a couple of weeks ago saying the Chinese have some problems with a few lines. As it's a pretty big book and a few lines in the book. And so the publisher's holding the whole thing up. And Mark, to your point, he's about ready to say, screw it.
What?
Yeah. I'm writing the book I want to write. But
yeah.
So this is all very real, which is why we have to go to Jamie's point about how you've humanized this situation, Admiral. There are some terrific characters. And I was with Jamie. I was kind of reading him going, oh, please tell me he survives. Please tell me. Come on. Admiral Sarah Hunt and a Marine aviator call sign Wedge, which those call signs for pilots are always so goofy. Wedge is not exactly, you know, the most intimidating.
But Wedge is, you know, where
Wedge, Star Wars.
Yeah, it's Star Wars.
Pilot
Wedge,
of all time.
He's like the only other guy that helped blow up the Death Star. Wedge.
Yeah.
Wedge Antilles.
I'm just telling you.
Also recall that a wedge is the oldest and simplest tool known to man. And believe me, Chris Mitchell, Wedge, is right out of the volleyball scene in Top Gun.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay, so talk about Wedge. You could take Wedge or Sarah Hunt, either one. Tell us about both of them and your inspiration for them, because I did hear an interview, which I hope was accurate, about your inspiration for Wedge.
So these are the two Americans in the book, and it's an international cast.
Yes,
there's an Indian-American. There's an Indian retired vice admiral. There's a Russian. There's an Iranian. And, of course, there's the Chinese admiral, Lin Bao. But the two Americans are Sarah Hunt, who probably professionally resembles me the most in terms of surface warfare officer, commands at every level, strike group commander, commodore, ship captain. But she physically resembles me the least. Not only is she a woman, but I picture her as kind of tall with really great hair.
Good tennis player. I heard she was a really good tennis player.
And a really good tennis player.
Yeah, I heard that. Yep.
And so she is complicated. She was in the Navy SEAL program in the middle of her career, broke her leg, ended up back in the surface Navy. carries the burden of command with great difficulty. And I think in that sense, I think is a very honest character, a very three-dimensional character. And the end of the novel for Sarah, without revealing things, I think is very poignant and very real. And then Chris Wedge Mitchell, again, is, you know, I've known Wedge's, Elliot Ackerman, who's a Marine officer. We've known plenty of Wedges. He personifies that sort of straight ahead Marlboro smoking American pilot type. And the character that I like the most, Tori, is actually the Chinese Admiral Lin Bao. And you'll
fascinating, fascinating character.
Yeah. And you'll appreciate this as a Washingtonian, all of you will. Here's this seagoing Chinese admiral who is posted to become the defense attaché. So he's driving, sailing a desk in the Chinese embassy. And all he wants is to get back to sea. He just wants to be with sailors, to lead his sailors, to defend his nation, to see the horizon of the sea. And eventually he gets his wish. But along the way, difficulties ensue because his mother was American. His father was Chinese. There's a taint of suspicion that follows him. There's a lot to like about Admiral Lin Bao. And then finally, these two Indians, an Indian-American Deputy National Security Advisor, Tori, you'd recognize in one second the snappy early 40s National Security Advisor staff that you had to slap around when you were the...
They always, to interrupt for a second, the types that used to always walk around very briskly.
Yeah.
They would put their materials, they could have their freaking grocery list and they'd put it in one of the covers they use for top secret material. So you would think they were important. Exactly. And they'd always have the classification on the outside of the envelope leaning out. And they always walked around very briskly, like they knew what they were doing.
Yeah. These were the people that our mutual boss, Don Rumsfeld, would eat for breakfast. Anyway, Sandy Chaudhuri is that character, and he's got, you know, kind of life problems. He's divorced. His ex-wife doesn't like him as usual. His mother doesn't like the ex-wife. There's a childcare issue. So he's got a complicated life backstory. But my other favorite character is Vice Admiral Patel, retired Indian Navy, this kind of man of international mystery, who manufactures this third party channel to India, and India plays, I think, a very surprising role in the novel. So that's a bit about the characters.
Awesome. Jamie McIntyre, can you think, and you've covered national security for more in the Pentagon for more than 20 years. Have you seen all these people? Have you met these types of people?
Oh yeah. That's what I said. It really, you know, not to overuse the word, but the word verisimilitude, which is, you know, it was very,
it's a big
very,
word. You can use it three or four times.
Very,
the
I had no doubt I was watching real characters. I want to put on my Pentagon reporter's hat, and I want to ask the Admiral just two quick policy questions. Mm-hmm. So the first one, and one is sort of a, you know, how bad could it be? And one is what might be better. But so first of all, there's a big debate in Washington now about whether the United States should change its policy of strategic ambiguity for something that would be more like strategic clarity. And for people who don't know, that we've maintained this ambiguous policy with regarding Taiwan about what the U.S. would do if China were to finally get frustrated and try to take over Taiwan and unite it or reunite it with China. Admiral, first of all, I'd like to ask you, what do you think? Should the U.S. maintain its current policy of not really saying what it would do, or should we substitute something that's a more clear declaration that the U.S. would defend Taiwan if China were to invade?
I would go with the former, but I would add to it a tranche of additional support. So think of it as strategic ambiguity plus, which is to say we maintain that policy, but we give them more advanced weapon systems. We sell them, I should say. We train with them more. We exchange high-level visitors. We have Track 2. We send the 7th Fleet to exercise with them. So in that sense, we draw closer to Taiwan. And I was there just before pandemic times. I met with Madam Tsai, their very remarkable woman president. You know, Taiwan has just crushed the virus. It's a vibrant society of 35 million people. It's almost the 30th largest economy in the world. It's a significant, serious place. But I think strategic ambiguity avoids breaking the relationship with China. So I call it strategic ambiguity plus is where I would park it, Jamie.
So your novel points out sort of a worst case, perhaps not the worst case, but a bad case scenario for how things go. What actions should the United States take now to prevent that scenario from unfolding? Are there things the U.S. can and should do right now to make sure that we don't sleepwalk into war with China?
Yes, and I'll give you four or five in 2 minutes. Number one, let's
It's the Blinkist version.
Yeah. Number one, have a plan. You know, I give the Trump administration credit for correctly observing that it's a looming power moving toward us. They had no plan. They were all over the map. 1 minute, it's big boozy dinner in Mar-a-Lago and President Xi is the new BFF. And then 10 minutes later, it's 40% tariffs across the board on Chinese goods. You cannot construct a strategy if you're just going to be episodically tactical. So create a plan. That plan ought to have a military component, which is to match up with China on the key things of 21st century warfare. That's artificial intelligence, machine learning, unmanned vehicles, special forces, the new marine concept to operate behind the island chains. We could go in great boring depth here. I won't. You need to match with China. Number three, allies, partners, and friends. Let's get this out of a U.S. versus China, and let's get it into China versus a great number of countries, particularly on South China Sea. By the way, in case you missed it, the British just deployed a carrier strike group centered on their brand new 60,000-ton aircraft carrier, the Queen Elizabeth, with destroyers, frigates, nuclear submarine, auxiliaries, and a U.S. destroyer part of that strike group. But it's a British one. Where is it deploying to? Ding, 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 South China Sea. So
F-35's on there too, right?
Bang.
The new stealth fighter.
Correct. And then finally, there's a huge economic component here. We need to be smart about where we apply sanctions, tariffs, restart the tariff talks. But here again, it's allies, partners, and friends. It's think seriously about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, bringing that back into the conversation. I'll close by saying there's also a cultural component here, which we discussed earlier. We cannot allow China to cancel us. That doesn't work. And I think if we had a plan that sort of brought all those elements together and executed it intelligently, I think we can match China and draw our allies and partners together with us. Last thought, India will be huge in this. India will be huge.
Yeah.
You know, we're in a podcast, but watch my hands or imagine them. Over here, U.S., European Union, Japan, Australia, New Zealand, the world's democracies. Over here, China and Russia. What's down here in the middle? It's India, this vast democracy, English as a lingua franca, young population, many challenges at the moment. The degree to which we pull India over here with those other democracies is the degree to which we balance China in this 21st century.
I'm feeling smarter. I don't know about you guys, but I'm feeling smarter. Yeah. Okay.
I'm feeling more hopeful too. I was feeling a little.
We can bring you right down, Jamie. Just hang on. So Admiral, our former boss, Secretary Rumsfeld, liked to talk a lot about the failure of imagination.
Yes.
And an anecdote he told all the time. Jamie probably covered it. His confirmation hearing in January of 2001, 6 or 7 hours, he got asked a lot of questions about a lot of issues, was never asked about Afghanistan or Al-Qaeda or the Taliban, right? 9 months later, look where we were. So he talks a lot about it. But without giving too much away, can you talk about in the book 2034, the Wen Rei incident and its connection to our failure of imagination?
I certainly can. And let me, before I do that, let me take you back just over 100 years ago. So 1914.
It's an hour-long podcast, Admiral. You know,
no problem. I'm going to do this in 1 minute. 1914. Here are all these countries of Europe.
Yeah.
Their economies completely integrated. War was inconceivable in 1910 to 1912. People are writing best-selling books about the end of war, kind of like Francis Fukuyama's The End of History, all written before 1914. What happens in August of 1914? An assassination, a single bullet kills a member of the Austro-Hungarian Empire's royal family. 4 years later, there is no Austro-Hungarian Empire. There is no Russian Empire. There is no Ottoman Empire. The world has completely turned on its axis, and you can drop a plumb line to the Great Depression and the Second World War. So single incidents, small hinges, swing big doors. So the Wen Re incident, which opens the novel 2034, is three American destroyers on a relatively routine freedom of navigation patrol. They encounter the Chinese vessel Wen Re. It appears to be in distress. They respond as they should to a distress at sea, smoke coming off the vessel. Commodore Hunt sees what's happening. An incident unfolds like the assassin's bullet. It becomes seemingly a small incident that leads to bigger and bigger escalation, and these two nations end up in war. Happened in 1914. It could certainly happen, unfortunately, in 2034.
It's fascinating that you mentioned that, Admiral. I just spent last week, for no apparent reason, I spent like 3 hours trying to figure out what the hell caused World War I.
Yeah.
And I read and I read and I read and I read, and I still don't know what caused it.
David, I have the answer for you. Okay. Go read Barbara Tuchman's The Guns of August.
Yes, exactly. It
is,
right.
Yeah. It is a brilliant read. And I feel like we're in like the preamble to
we
the
are.
Guns of August here in the 21st century.
100%.
Yeah. So, but seriously, David, it's one of the greatest reads. It's history. It's nonfiction, and it reads like a novel. It's amazing.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's a good one. Plausible is the word that keeps coming up again and again and again, Admiral. When I read it, listening to Jamie in every review, and that is what makes this so scary, because everything in this book absolutely, positively could happen, and we have all seen small things become big things. Talk. A little bit. Oh, this is fabulous. I'm killing Deserted Island. talk a little bit about, and I know you can give us the numbers, on cyber. Sure. And why do you care so much about cyber? And how do we create cyber deterrence the way we've created nuclear deterrence? As you spoke earlier in the show, we have created a system, if you will, that has helped prevent nuclear war. But how do we create the same kind of being in cyber? But give us the numbers on cyber and why we should be so scared, because I want everyone to be terrified by the time they finish listening to this podcast.
Yeah, I'll give you the trifecta of cyber, which have all occurred in the last 4 weeks. Russia attacks hundreds of U.S. companies in what's been called the Solar Winds hack, penetrating 400 of the Fortune 500 companies in every element of the U.S. government. Number two, China, using Microsoft exchanges, punches through email in hundreds and hundreds of U.S. companies and governments. And ding, 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 2 days ago, the largest pipeline company in the United States has a ransomware attack by a Russian cyber criminal organization, which clearly has ties to the Kremlin, which shuts down for a period of time our entire gasoline supply across 5,500 miles of pipe, 45% of the liquid fuel in the East Coast of the United States. This is real. And to give you the ultimate numbers, it's the threat surface. 10 years ago, there were about 7 billion devices connected to the internet, same number of devices as people on the planet Earth. Today, there are 50 billion devices connected to the internet. Hey, that's great, right? I can pick up my iPhone 10 and open my garage door from 100 miles away. Terrific. But it's also 50 billion paths into the castle. And so we are in a moment in which offense is outpacing defense, and we are vulnerable, as the most recent attack on the pipeline shows. So what should we do about it? We should be working more internationally with our allies, yeah, partners, and friends. We should be working with the interagency, bringing it together. You know, we have a U.S. cabinet that's perfectly configured for the 19th century. We have a Secretary of Agriculture. Really? 6% of the country work on farms. We have a Secretary of the Interior managing 55 national parks. Okay. We don't have anybody focused on cyber and cybersecurity in the cabinet of the United States. We need to fix that. And lastly, I could go on for hours on this subject. We need a cyber force. As surely as we have an Army, Navy, Marine Corps, Air Force, now we have a Space Force, good move. We need a cyber force. So there's a very few ideas and a sense of the risk that's involved here. And yes, Tori, we should be building up regimes of deterrence, because these offensive cyber weapons approach the level of nuclear effect on a society. Deterrence ultimately is going to be the only way to prevent nations using these cyber tools against each other.
And do you think some of our allies, Jamie, if I start to ask something really stupid, just stop me. But do you think some of our allies, some of whom have been ignored for a while, would be willing to engage with us on this?
100%. Absolutely. Yeah, and many are. And many are, particularly the ones you would expect, but maybe one you don't expect. So the Brits, very much. The French, quite capable in this zone. The Israelis, very, very good.
Yeah.
We're in conversations with them and with others. There's a NATO cybersecurity center. Japanese are pretty good. This is a conversation that's bubbling, and it should.
Wow. Okay. We got to get you out with this question. What are we not thinking about that we should be thinking about? You raise this really incredibly important issue in this book, 2034. You humanize it in a way that many people can relate and appreciate and be scared by it, and they should be scared by it, and be, as Jamie said, absolutely entranced with this book, because it is a page turner. But what else are we not thinking about that we should be thinking about?
Well, here's shameless plug number two. We just signed a 2-book sequel deal to 2034. And it's going to be 2054 and 2074. It's going to continue the story deep into this century.
Awesome.
Working titles, and it's the answer to your question. 2054, a novel of the Second World War. Correction, a novel of the Second Civil War. We need to be paying attention to these divisions inside our nation. 2074, a novel of the climate crisis. So I would say our internal divisions and climate are the two big issues. And there are plenty of smart folks thinking about them, but I don't think we have seen the edges of despair to which we may end up if we don't pay more attention in those two zones.
Awesome. Do you think you're going to be in fiction for a while?
I'm certainly doing 2 more books. I just signed the contract. That may be the extent of my remit. In fiction. My next nonfiction book, which I hope to come back and talk to you, is called To Risk It All. And it's a book about decision-making, how we make the hardest decisions in our lives.
Awesome. Well, you'll have to come back. I've decided that Admiral Servius is going to be like those people who brag about how many times they host Saturday Night Live. 13 times.
In the five hosts.
Having watched Elon Musk, I'm not sure I ever want to try and do that.
I tortured myself by watching that the other night. I had to turn it off. Yeah. I felt badly for him,
so
everybody
awkward.
Around him.
So awkward.
It was terrible. Yeah. Okay, I'm going to dispense with all the housekeeping except this. We are going to be back next week with Jesse Washington. David, tell us about Jesse Washington and his book on John Thompson.
Well, Jesse works for the Undefeated at ESPN. Very good writer. And he... Finally, John consented before he passed away to write his autobiography.
Yeah.
And he wound up doing it with Jesse. And it's a wonderful book. I mean, it's a wonderful book about Washington, D.C. And the city that he grew up in and the challenges that he had growing up and how they kind of shaped his life and why he became the adult and basketball coach that he became. So it's called I Came as a Shadow.
Came as a Shadow, yeah.
It's a wonderful book. And he's a great conversationalist about it. So I think you'll enjoy it.
Excellent. We want everybody to come back for that. Hey, we want everybody.
Yes. I know.
What is your next book about?
I agree.
Yes, I agree. I like that idea. It's a good idea. I like that.
In the meantime, as people are waiting for David Aldrich's first book, they should go buy 2034, A Novel of the Next World War by Admiral James Stavridis and Elliot Ackerman.
A very tall and handsome Elliot Ackerman.
It's really terrific. Admiral, last question. What does it say in Chinese on the front of the book?
2034.
Okay, I should have figured that out. That's dumb. Thanks, everybody. I love you. Come back next week.